Speaker tonight is Tom.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom. Can you hear me back there? You should be able to hear me back there. I'm getting better at this, actually. I'm not quite as destroyed before I got up here tonight. If you've never sat in the front row and gotten your mind together and then got up and turned around and looked at this crowd, it's an experience. And if you get used to it, you're probably in trouble. So talk to your sponsor. I said, does anybody have a job of counting how many people have days? I said, see, do you? Well, how many people? It had to be 40 or 50. I lost count of the people that were counting days. That's a good job for next term. That's awesome. It absolutely stopped my thinking. The responsibility of a group and an area to work with newcomers to get them the best information available to help them stay sober is a tremendous undertaking. When I got sober, it was like one or two people any particular night, you know, that were trying to get sober. And you knew who they were. They were very visible. They were not dressed as we are. They did not smell as we do, and they didn't talk at all. They seemed to yell in incoherent cursing, and you didn't ask them how many days they had. You know, it was obvious, and the old timers descended on them like vultures because they knew that two things happened: people's lives were saved, and we got to stay sober. So it was a fair trade-off. I was coming up Park Avenue tonight, and as I do, I notice, now I can notice when my surroundings are different. Park Avenue is changing. It is that time again. And unlike my two preceding speakers, and I'm very grateful for them and are envious of them having families that they had, I was not one of those people that had this mom and pop kettle family. I would not even know how to describe them, but they were not exactly normal. So when I got sober, I had many years of abnormal holidays to reflect on at my first Christmas. And I was the person that they mentioned out of the big book just now, and you got to find out why he stayed sober. I was the person who never got his family back. Amongst many other people in this room. It's not a prerequisite to get sober that things get the way we want them to get. You know, some of us get our families back and we wish they hadn't. Some of us don't get our families back and wish we had. And some of us, very fortunate of you who are there, have good families that stay good on into sobriety, and that's wonderful, and you should enjoy the holidays. But there are those of us who did not have that and had to deal with the holidays as they are. So I get to be the bad guy. I tell you how they are. They are different. They are loud. They are violently reminiscent of the drinking days that we had. There will be days and days of reminders of what you're not doing if you're counting days, and this is your first Christmas. You will meet somebody about my age who will look at you and say, it's just another day. It's been my experience. You should find someone else to talk to at that point. If you go over to Ireland and tell those people St. Patrick's Day is just another day, you'll probably wind up in a fight. Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's Day are not just another day. They are huge, huge triggers for most of us. So it is to your benefit if you find some people, get close to a group like this group. If they have activities, go to them. If they have things to do on Thanksgiving, go to them. If they have things to do over the holidays, go to them. Do not do what I did in the first 5 or 10 years by absolutely attacking you with, I'm fine, I have somewhere to go, I have something to do. People asked me over to dinner, but thank you so much for asking me. And I sat in front of my TV and watched the balloons go down Central Park West by myself, thinking about killing myself. Because I didn't think anybody really wanted me to come. It was a pity invite, you know. they want you to come, so go. I was very close to drinking for a lot of years because I was without family, without child, without wife, without money, without anything, and everybody seemed to be having these extraordinary, joyous, seasonal encounters. My life was not exactly described at that point, and the only thing I knew how to do besides taking my next breath was pick up a drink, and it was only by the grace of God and my sponsors and my group that I didn't. So if you're new, get close to the program. More people go out and drink between Thanksgiving and New Year's that have time than the rest of the year combined, and I know that because I've been around long enough to see them come back, those who survive. It's a very, very hard time, so that's enough of that. Enough said, I've done my Christmas message, so the people that have asked me to do it, that's done. You'll hear people say how wonderful it is. You'll go into Bloomingdale's on Saturday and let me know how it is. All the people that worked for me went out for lunch today, and I was involved with some stuff, and I noticed that 2.5 hours later they weren't back yet, so I knew it had started, you know. And I was a nice boss when I came back, so then I really knew it started. I'm an alcoholic. I have a disease. It's called alcoholism. If you're in here tonight and you have a problem with alcohol and it has been noted to you that you might be an alcoholic and you stay in these rooms for more than a month and put up with our nonsense, you probably are. And if you are and you suffer from the same problem I suffer from, then there's a good chance you are. And if you are, you're an alcoholic. And if you're an alcoholic, you have a disease. And if you have that disease, then you have the chance to get sober like everyone else did. If you are different, however, then you are going to have problems. But you see, I have a physiological chemical imbalance in my body. It's called alcoholism. I have always had it. I did not know that. And when I drink, I change in ways that are not appealing. When I think about drinking, I change in ways that are not appealing. I have been fortunate enough in my sobriety to have the ability to hear things that are said to me and to strike me into a sober stance and to impart on me a wisdom of the old timers that I have never forgotten. And the thing to this day that has made the most impact on me was a beautiful old guy that probably looked like I do now, who at my 50th or 100th meeting said to me, "Hey, kid, you're going to wake up tomorrow." His name is Jimmy Fox. He was out of the South Bronx East Group years ago. He said, "Kid, you're going to wake up tomorrow and you're not going to be an alcoholic. What are you going to do?" And I said, "Oh, Jimmy, I'd have a drink." And he said, "No, you wouldn't." He said, "It wouldn't occur to you." Now, he could have said, "You wouldn't think about it. It would not have made an impression on me." He said, "It would never occur to you not to have a drink." And I went home and I thought about that. And the ramifications of that struck me to the core. And the fact of the matter was, after I picked up a drink at the age of 15, to right now, it has been impossible for it not to occur to me. It is like the silent impasse in my brain that tells me to take my next breath. After I drank, it was have another drink. Because it was the link in my DNA that created and made me a whole person. And you see, guys, I'm an alcoholic. If I wasn't an alcoholic, that would not have happened to me. What would have happened to me was what happened to the kid next to me when we had our first drink together, and we looked at each other, and he says, "Yeah, that was good." It wasn't good. It wasn't a beverage. It was the answer. And I couldn't tell you that was the answer then. All as I know is I had another drink, and the second drink did the same thing to me, and everything that ever mattered and ever would matter was taken care of. Now, I couldn't register that in an English sentence. All as I knew was, you know, this is it. Because for the first 15 years of my life, I walked around with both feet planted in midair, suffering from those ungrounded and unfounded fears that alcoholics have. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew it was going to happen. I didn't know who was going to get me, but somebody was going to get me. I didn't know I was going to fail the test, but I was going to fail the test. I knew. And I suffered from those fears. Now, if I would have fallen into any other 40, 50 different classifications of neurotic when I picked up the drink, I would have just been those classifications of neurotic but drunk. But you see, what happened was all of the things that was going on in my head stopped going on when I had that drink. And I have heard thousands of different definitions on what happened when people pick up a drink. And it was never satisfying to me just never made sense in the way it happened. I couldn't describe what happened, you know. I even went into the movie 2001 and paraphrased the guy that said, you know, the ethereal thing, alien that said, it was wonderful, you know. And I said, well, that's close, but it still doesn't cut it. What happened to me, in my opinion, was the mental and spiritual part of the disease went to sleep when I drank. So what I was left was with me, the kid, the child, the spirit. 15 years old, and for the first time in my life, I experienced who I was without the active mental and spiritual part of the disease plaguing me on a daily basis. Now, I still have that disease. It still tells me things, only different things, you know, different sentences that the disease will tell me. The spiritual part and the mental part still talk to me on a daily basis, and they're still there. And left untreated without a spiritual remedy for this disease, I would start to listen to them. And I would start to believe them. And if I told you what they said, they would say, how could you possibly believe that? Whatever it is, until I tell you what you've been believing about your day in your head, and you'll say, well, yeah, I guess you're right, you know. I'm an alcoholic. So those noises went away, and I felt wonderful, and I had another drink, and I felt better. And I could never, ever put down a drink of alcohol. I couldn't put it down. It's the only time now I use the word can't and when I describe things. Because I was physically, mentally, and spiritually incapable by myself, unaided, to stop drinking alcohol because of what it did for me. And it didn't make me happy, and it didn't make me dance better. It did. It didn't make me a better scholar. It did. It didn't make me get along with people better. It did. It didn't make me accomplish all the things that I accomplished because it did. But the fact is, it didn't. I did all of those things by myself, aided, with the absence of the mental and spiritual part of the disease. With the fear gone, I could be what God intended me to be. And I was. And it was fine. And it was wonderful. And if it still worked, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be out there having two or three martinis and going home. But you see, I have a chemical imbalance that causes progression. The progression is noticed in all of our stories. It starts at different stages and it continues. And everything gets worse with less of the medicine. The fear gets worse, the situations get worse, the thinking gets worse, the physical ramifications of the disease get worse, and the amount of alcohol that it takes to settle them down is more, and it's an endless 8-track tape that goes on a daily basis that we try to quell and hide and fix, because the answer is the drink. The answer was always the drink, and that was true. You know, everybody used to call me a fatalist. I said, I would all these shrinks, they would say these things that made no sense to me. I said, if all these things happen, then how am I a fatalist? I'm a realist, you know? If I drink and I get in trouble all the time and I say I'll probably get in trouble again when I drink, that's not being a fatalist. That's being, hello, that's what's happening, you know? You know, if I can't stop drinking and if my progression is worse and I believe it's going to get worse. You see, but they didn't understand alcoholism. They still don't, most of them. They had no schooling on it. They had 2 hours on what alcohol does to the liver, and that was it. So when I went to them, and they saw me and my 5-finger distended liver, they looked at me and said, stop drinking. And I went to the shrinks, and the shrinks said, stop drinking. And my family said, stop drinking. You know, I picked up a drink when I was 15 years of age and meant no harm to anybody on the planet except I had to fulfill my disease's wishes for me on a basis. You know, if I could have drank without getting in trouble, trust me, I would have. If I could have drank without stealing and ruining your life and getting involved with people and ruining their lives and lying to people and disappointing people, I would have done that because I'm not a bad person and I don't want people to suffer. But you see, the fact of the matter is, as an alcoholic, I have to drink. And what happens is a consequence of my drinking. I cannot control that, and it's the price you have to pay because, you see, I'm taking another breath. You're looking at me like I'm overindulging in beverage, and it's bad of me. It's not right. So you're either going to divorce me or fire me or do something to me to get me out of your life because, you see, I'm not playing by your rules, which is stop drinking. See, I couldn't stop drinking. So the kid at the age of 15 that has this progressive disease that's looking for help, I go to the medical profession and I go to the shrinks and I tell them, you know, lies, you know. I drink a pint a day, you know. And they look at me like, you know, I'm a criminal because I'm 18 years old. Kid drinking a pint a day, and I'm drinking a quart a day. But, I, you know, I cut everything in half, and they're still, you know, they're still weird. So they decide that what they're going to do is they're going to cure me, because in the middle 60s, alcoholism was the result of. And they had pages and pages and books of what caused alcoholism. And I read most of them, and I agreed with most of them. You know, I was a result of the becauses, because of my mother, because of my present wife then, because of whatever, the nuns were big, you know. If the one with the mustache hadn't beaten me every day. And that's probably true. I'm probably still bent in some areas because of that. But it didn't cause my alcoholism, you know. And if my mother wouldn't have been the person she was, I'd probably be a different person, and that's true, too. And if my first wife wouldn't have been the person she was, I'd be a different person. But whatever and whoever that person would have been, he still would have been an alcoholic. And I'd just be telling a different story and blaming some other people, you know. The fact of the matter was, they had issues, and I was an alcoholic, and it was like a perfect highball, you know. We mixed perfectly. So the shrinks got me and said, well, when we can take care of that, maybe we can straighten your life out. And I said, you're absolutely right. And they got me started on all of the things the medical profession believed we should do to stop our alcoholism. And it came in medicine, it came in pills, it came in injections, it came in a lot of forms that I took because I didn't want to drink that way. I didn't want to hurt you. I didn't want to hurt people. I wanted a normal life. So if you told me you had to inject this or I should take that, I took it. You see, but I wasn't one of these people that had any kind of intelligence so that when it didn't work, I said, didn't work, and I would go back to drinking. I'm a more person. I definitely are next and more as my problems. They're still my problems because I can hardly get into my suits anymore, so more is the thing I still do. So I drank on top of these things that these doctors thought were going to cure me, and my progression, like, tripled. So by the time I'm 21, I'm late-stage chronic alcoholic with all of the manifestations that the doctors recognize 3 feet in the door. You know, I have the spiders on my face. For those who don't know that, they're the red lines, that the ruptures of the veins on the face from the drinking. My liver's distended. I'm bloated. My chemistry comes back with blinking lights on the envelope. And they tell me I'm in trouble. You know, and I love the people who gave me obvious things. I knew I was in trouble. All the people in here counting days today, by yourself, alone, if you're going to be honest with someone, you're going to say, I'm in a lot of trouble. You're not going to be sitting here raising your hand saying you have 5 days because it's an exercise from your office. You're in trouble. And if your disease isn't quenched by Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a good chance you'll be dead soon. And if you think I'm lying, I'll talk to you after the meeting about all the people I've buried in the last 35 years. Alcoholism kills. It is not waiting for me outside my door in the morning doing push-ups. It is not around the bush down on Park Avenue. It doesn't take ethereal forms floating over my bed. It is not I am the alcoholic. It's me. It's my brain. It's my mind. It's my personality. It's me. I'm an alcoholic. I don't wait for myself in the morning. Somehow we found a way to blame outside forces for what we do, say, think, and believe after we get sober. That's me you're talking to. And everything I do sober, I did when I was drunk, most of them, except drink. I am capable of anything, and that's why they have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol allowed me to be who I am, the good, the bad, the ugly. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of work had to be done. But there I was at the age of 20, 21, raging alcoholic, you know, and they didn't know what to do with me. They had no idea. There was a woman out in Freeport. I'll get to that. I'm skipping. I want to skip fast. I want to get into that. I went into the service, came out of the service. Everybody knew I was an alcoholic. Came out. It was Vietnam. I came back home, went into my living room. I hadn't seen my wife at that point in 2 years, a year and a half. Walked in, walked past her, went into the medicine cabinet, took out a bottle of barbiturates, went and got a quart of scotch, and sat down at the dining room table and figured out what the hell I was going to do with the rest of my life. Because I couldn't stop drinking, and I knew it. And I made a decision that night that I was going to do what I had to do to survive the best way I could until it was over. That's not something 30-year-olds usually do. Not 30-year-olds, 25-year-olds usually do. 25. I was planning on a chemically induced life. I knew how much I drank. The United States Army knew how much I drank. Everybody knew how much I drank. So I went forward and I kept going. And the next years were nothing more than the end and the bodic of chronic late-stage alcoholism. And at the age of 26, I was in a mental institution. This was about the 25th hospital, about the third or fourth mental institution. I was under the treatment of a woman out in Long Island who was a doctor who believed in antabuse. Antabuse is a drug that if you take and you drink, you get very ill, very ill. And she had my then wife put two tabs of antabuse under my tongue every morning. And after I got the last rites the third time on that, I decided it was a bad idea to take antabuse. Because, you see, I'm an alcoholic, and when I get an obsession and a compulsion to drink, as the book said, there is no human power. Nothing stopped me. And I wound up one particular day in 1969, 1970, throwing in the towel, as the stories tell in the back of the big book. Everybody has that point when nothing is working. They've tried everything. They've done the doctors. They've done the shrinks. They've done the acupuncture. They've done the rabbis and the priests. They've done everything. They've said the I'm sorry's to every relative they've ever seen. They've looked at the faces of their mothers or fathers knowing that they were going to die. They're just so tired of trying not to drink that the only thing left is to go to that last place that we go. And I took 120 pills and drank a quart of scotch and went to sleep. I knew what I was doing. And I woke up about 8 hours later because my body thought it was breakfast. And I wound up in another mental ward with doctors saying, why are you so destructive? In an effort to survive my disease during my lifetime, I have done a lot of destructive things, but the motivation was not destructive. The motivation was to survive. And that's the insanity of the second step. I don't set upon things to be destructive. It is the only answer I have. I don't want to die. I take it. And if you're hurt, I'm sorry. But I wasn't quite thinking about you, you know, at that point. I was thinking about living. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, out of that mental ward that I wound up in, it was because some 18-year-old nurse said, why don't you go to AA? And I came into AA because I had not tried it, and they were going to throw me out of the mental ward if I didn't do what I was told. And I sat in an institution meeting, and I listened to some guy talk about AA, and then I went to a regular meeting. And I heard a guy by the name of Jack Brennan talk about the disease of alcoholism, and I heard him for an hour and a half, and it was the day after Bill Wilson died. Bill Wilson had died the night before, and I'm sitting in the room. I'm 240 pounds. I got two different colored shoes on. I haven't shaved. I haven't bathed. I'm throwing convulsions every half hour or so. I'm drinking two quarts of scotch, taking 20 to 30 barbiturates and 9 ounces of paraldehyde every day, and I was doing that for the 5 or 6 years before I came in here. So I wasn't one of the fortunate people today that raised their hands in their suits and say, I got 12 days. You know, I couldn't even talk. And I heard this guy talk about the disease of alcoholism. Nobody had ever said that to me. They talked about the issue, the problem, the addiction, the result, the situation, but never the disease. And he talked and he talked and he talked and he told me who I was. And then he said he was sober at that point in time, 23 years. And he had been institutionalized in Kings County 15 or 20 times. And I'm listening, my mouth is open. And I continue to go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis because they said the only message in AA, which is if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length, that's it. I'm Tom Ubertus, I'm an alcoholic, I'm sober because of the grace of God in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I have to tell you. You know, we over these last 73 years have gotten very intellectual, but that's the message. If you want to get sober, you have to find out what we're doing. You have to follow us, you have to ask questions, and we'll tell you. But we're not going to go out and grab your feet and tie you up and put you in a chair and make you get sober. And these guys didn't either. Their answer was, I'll meet you down, I'll wait downstairs for you tomorrow night for 5 minutes. And they did, 5 minutes. If I was in the bathroom more than 5 minutes, they weren't there. And I would get in their car every night, and I went to meetings, and I surrendered at one point, and I went away, and they took me to a drunk farm upstate. There were no rehabs, and then after that, I wound up in a mental hospital because I couldn't cope. And my sponsor took me and after that and showed me the big book and the 12 and 12 and showed me what service and showed me what love was. And he showed me what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. And he said, if you want what we have, watch what we're doing. And what they were doing then and what they do on the West Coast and the structure that they talk about that's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 70 years is what goes on in this group and what goes on in the Pacific group. And when I got sober, went on in all groups, which is that the group is the answer to everything. The sponsor is the answer to everything. The steps and the traditions are the answers to everything. If you want what we have and you want to stay sober and live a fulfilling, wholesome life, thank you, you will do what is suggested. You don't have to. You don't have to. There was the old joke, you don't have to pull the ripcord when you jump out of the plane on your parachute either. You know, you don't have to. You know, and there's always guys like me that if you wait long enough and listen long enough, I will tell you how many people have died. I will tell you how they died. And I will make a point out of telling you how much money they had when they died and how many wives and kids they owned, or if they were gay, what their partners felt looking at the coffin. I will tell you all those things, and it won't impress you because you're different. You see, because I'm different. But my sponsor believed in show and tell, so he said to me very early on, you got a suit? And I said, yeah. He says, I'll meet you on Castle and Tremont Avenue in 2 hours. I thought I was going to a party. So I put on my suit, and I said, where are we going? He said, we're going to McCune's across the street. And we walked into McCune's, and there was this guy in the coffin that I had been pointed to look at about 6 months before by my sponsor's elbow. Listen to this guy. So I'm listening. This guy's crazy. Just listen to him. I said, what's he talking about? He said, just listen. After me, you heard what? Fine. So 5 months later, when he's in the coffin, John says, you want to go there? Do what he was doing. End of the meeting. He doesn't have to explain to me. The guy wasn't making meetings. He was complaining about everything. He wasn't doing what was suggested. And 5 months later, show and tell, at the age of 35 or whatever he was, he's dead. He didn't plan on it, but he was dead. And he was to do this with me over and over and over. And then he said, you know, I'm not making a big enough impression on this kid. So he got me involved in institution work. So then I found all the people that were missing meetings. They were in the institutions. And I would walk out of Bronx State Hospital on the nights that I carried it, and I had no problems in the world. Nothing that was wrong with me was anything like what was wrong with them. And then I got involved with the detoxes, then I got involved with general service, then I got involved with intergroup, and then I got involved and involved and involved and involved. Because that's what the old-timers did. That's what the old-timers in this room do. You know, Peggy's always in the front row here. Every time I'm here, she's here. The old-timers and Van, God rest his soul, was always here. The people I knew when I came in, you know, when I came in, they were down here, around here, a lot of them, because I moved out of the Bronx, and they welcomed me. If you're an alcoholic and you're in this room tonight and you're counting days or you're counting years, you stop doing that, I'll be watching you. Because, you see, I got more to lose now than I've ever had to lose before. So I got to watch you much harder. I got to watch every mistake you make, and I got to see what it does to you. Because I could make those mistakes. Because I'm as gullible and as tired. You know, now I have things like, I'm tired. I'm older. You know, I'm in charge of a whole company. Well, you know, I got problems at home. You know, my diet isn't working. I haven't gone to the bathroom in a week, you know. So I got to hear about somebody who goes out because they haven't gone to the bathroom in a week. And, oh, okay, you know, I better do something about that. We laugh. But, you know, you want to share your secrets, we all have them. You know, I heard something about, you know, we're the only group of people on the planet as a whole who regret the future. Think about it. And as I get older, the future is getting, you know, you read the newspapers, oh my God, I'm going to be 75, I'm not going to have any money, and both parties are going to disown me, and I'm going to be in the street, and I'll drink. I've had those thoughts. Well, I can always drink. So I call my sponsor up, who's 76 and on dialysis down in Florida. Jerry Beckerman, he's on dialysis now from his 30 years with diabetes. He's got about 45 years sober. He's got a better attitude than I am, and he spends like an hour on dialysis at home. And as he says, yeah, but you see, my wife's with me for an hour. You know, I know what that means. You know, the guy's a saint. But we don't drink. We don't drink. The old timers, we're losing all our heroes. If you're new, if you're old. Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for a very, very long time. Get a group, get a sponsor, work the book, read the books, read the big book, read it with somebody, find out what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's not an issue, it's not an addiction, it's a physiological chemical imbalance that if you do not treat it, it will kill you, because it will convince you that little shot of Johnny Walker Red on the bar is okay. It'll make you forget the day, it'll make you forget your problems, it'll make people forget about you, and you will pass, and a year from now, you're just going to be a useful piece of information that we have about not drinking, but you're going to be dead. Thanksgiving is the day after tomorrow. Happy holidays. Stay safe, stay sober. Thank you.